Hi, folks. Public service announcement. Valentine's Day is just 8 days away. And if you're looking for the perfect treat for your sweetheart, SunsetLakeSabade.com is having a sale on all their sweet and tasty edible products. Now through February 9th, that's just 3 days from now, you can use the code Valentine26, Valentine26, all one word, to save 30% on all Sunset Lakes gummies, chocolate fudge, and even their farmer's roast infused coffee beans. In addition to the gummies that we all know and love, they've also just released a limited edition citrus flavor of their most popular, or their popular, I'm not sure, it's popular, their Vibe gummies. The Vibe gummies have a little bit of THC, just enough to help you get through one of these typical days these days. Maybe you get pre-date jitters. Maybe you get a little nervous. Well, one of these citrus Vibe gummies can help put your mind at ease. Or maybe you want to bring your date a box of sweets. Sunset Lake's Full Spectrum Chocolate Fudge is the perfect choice. The coffee is also great. That is my weekend brew when I want, I don't want to be as jittery and hyped as I am during the course of the week. And frankly, I have been leaning on the gummies a little bit more than normal these days. They got great gummies, obviously, to help you sleep as well. But the THC ones, they're fun, and particularly, you know, some of us can't deal with that, like, massive MGs of THC. I'm not looking at anybody in particular, but just about everybody in this office. So others of us, one meg does as well.
Some people think they can handle it, and then they don't handle it that well.
That's happened to me as well. Are you talking about yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about this.
I mean, I think people have seen that.
Okay.
The code again. Valentine26, Valentine26, no spaces, all one word, at SunsetLakeSabade.com. You'll save 30% on all edibles. This sale runs through February 9th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. As always, see the site for full terms and conditions. Check it out. And now time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday. Tuesday, Casual Tuesday. Wednesday, Casual Hump Day. Thursday, Casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 6th, 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jeet Heer, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine and host of the Time of Monsters podcast. Then, Dan Osborne, independent candidate for U.S. Senate in Nebraska, on the story of the Tyson plant that is going to close down in a town of 11,000 people. Almost half of them are employed by that Tyson plant. Also on the program today, major upset likely brewing in New Jersey's 11th special 11th district special election. This as AIPAC is hoisted on its own petard.
You love to hear it.
We'll talk about that more, obviously, soon. DHS shutdown grows more likely as Republicans rebuff Chuck Schumer's capitulation. U.S. and Iran in direct talks today in Oman. Virginia Democrats unveil new gerrymandered map with three potential Democratic pickups. January layoffs, highest in a January since 2009. That's in the wake of the massive financial crisis. Project 2025's Schedule F is about to be implemented. It will strip tens of thousands of federal employees of their civil service status. Trump convening a meeting of FBI and elections officials in an unprecedented attempt to federalize elections. Oklahoma eliminates tenure at all of its public colleges. Day 26 of New York City nurses' strike, reportedly some progress. Senator Ron Wyden is sounding the alarm on CIA activities. We just don't know what he's sounding the alarm about. UAW reaches a tentative agreement, historical one, with Volkswagen in Chattanooga. And lastly, just moments ago, Mamdani signs an executive order in New York City protecting New Yorkers from ICE. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is a casual
Friday.
Friday,
yes,
says Emma Vigeland. I get distracted. Someone just reminded me. In Indiana, there are Democrats running for every state Senate seat for the first time since 1974.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. All right.
So we will see. I mean, this is going to be there's a lot of things happening on the electoral front. A couple of days ago? Was it the beginning of the week when that special election in Texas happened?
I think it was, yeah.
Was it 6 months ago or was Monday? It like 4 days ago?
Yeah, I think that was Monday. That we got the news of that.
Elections on Tuesdays. It's throwing us. It's too much. We're already thrown off.
Like the NFL on Thursday?
What are you doing?
So at the beginning of the week, there was a special election in Texas in a state Senate seat where the Democrat made up 31 to 34 points. Donald Trump had won that district by 17 points, and the Democrat ended up winning it by something like 14 points. So maybe it was 31. That's a 31-point swing. It was also potential harbinger of what will happen in the midterms, because it suggested that the gains amongst Latinos that the Republicans had made had completely reversed themselves. And of course, those gains were in many instances in the redistricting in Texas, the basis of these new districts that it may have turned out to be a dummy mander. And now this in New Jersey, this is a Democratic primary. A Democrat is more than likely to win this district in the
very
general
blue
election.
District. This is my hometown district, so I'm quite proud of this result here. It's a heavy homeowner population, one of the wealthier districts in the country. It's a northern New Jersey suburb of New York City. And this is Mikey Sherrill's old district, and now that she has become the governor of New Jersey, they had to hold this special primary. So this is the primary here, and we have the results. Over 90% of the votes are counted. There's still some ballots that need to be counted, but it's razor-thin margins. Mejia, the progressive candidate, the WFP candidate, former Bernie 2020 organizer, endorsed by AOC, endorsed by Bernie, Warren, among others, is now ahead by around 600 votes. And there were a bunch of outlets that called it for Malinowski really early on in the night. And she had this
late
surge.
Well, we should tell people who Malinowski is.
Yeah.
Malinowski is a former congressman here. Leave that up. Malinowski is a former congressman. A moderate, I think you could say.
Definitely, yeah.
And by moderate, you know, sort of like a corporatist, conservative. I mean, however, and he had been a very faithful, and this is sort of like maybe the icing on the cake. It is a five-way race, and Malinowski was certainly favored. I mean, significantly.
Significantly.
And Malinowski has been a faithful funder of Israel, although he did say he was open to the idea, just open to the idea of potentially conditioning aid to Israel based upon, you know, how genocidal it becomes. And
that pissed AIPAC off. And they wanted apparently to make an example out of him, saying, like, you could be 95% of the way that we need you to be in terms of lockstep genocidally voting or whatever. But if you're not 100% with us, we're going to spend a boatload of money on and help one of your opponents. That's Way there, who came in third. The DMFI, also the Democratic Zionist funding.
Majority for Israel.
Yeah, they also backed her. And they backed her by funding her campaign, but most importantly, funding a bunch of ads against Malinowski.
Now, the interesting thing about the ads against Malinowski, reportedly they sent mailers talking about Israel as the topic. But in terms of like the TV spends, the AIPAC and its basically its front groups did what they do typically, which is not mention Israel at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, attack Malinowski as if they're attacking from the left. And they made a wild miscalculation in this instance, because the benefit of these attack ads ended up going to Meha, not to Way, who was their preferred candidate. And what's interesting about this is both that it may have a two different implications that would both be positive, aside from having a genuine progressive in that seat,
mm-hmm.
at least until 2026, where she would have to rerun again, but would be doing from the benefit of being an incumbent. It also might signal to the Democratic establishment, we need to stop having these people play in these races.
How do you think Haley Stevens is feeling right now? Now that she's been getting all this AIPAC money and is tied to them, she could cut it off tomorrow, and she's still the AIPAC candidate in Michigan.
And I'm not even talking from the perspective of Israel, but rather the Democratic establishment might see that, like, hey, wait a second, this is supposed to help us, not hurt us,
mm-hmm.
and not even even when it's under sort of like under the underground. Their decision making is a little bit suspect here. Now, of course, all this money comes from right wing donors. So at one point, the Democratic Party might want to make a some type of, and, you know, the best they can do is simply say, we're not going to provide you funds if there are outside expenditures that benefit you in any way, et cetera. There's ways of them at least discouraging it. The other thing is that it reiterates that Democrats should be taking a much more aggressive posture when it comes to funding DHS. Here is that ad.
In a special election to fill Mikey Sherrill's House seat, Tom Malinowski says he'll stand up to Trump. But hold on. In 2019, Tom Malinowski voted with Trump and the Republicans to fund ICE, more than $200 million for Trump's deportation force. $200 million that got us this? Democrats called Malinowski's vote a blank check for the Trump administration and a betrayal. We can't trust Tom Malinowski.
Pause for a sec.
He is responsible.
Wait, who's responsible for this ad? What does it say there really quickly? I just wanted to read the
bottom. Can't trust Tom Malinowski. UDP is responsible for the content of this ad.
Yeah, there it is. United Democracy Project is the AIPAC front. Unbelievable.
But, I mean, we could say the same thing about Chuck Schumer in that ad. I mean, that Chuck Schumer was instrumental in funding the DHS. Now, I think he voted against it. I can't remember exactly, but we know how he manipulated the whole thing. He didn't want to have a shutdown this time. He was again forced to do so. And so there's a lot of good things that could come out of this. And hopefully that 600 vote margin holds up. It's unclear whether this would trigger an automatic recount or not, at least on our end. We don't know yet.
But let me, I also just want to point out the county line piece of this is also immensely important. We saw that when New Jersey eliminated this county line, there was a big legal fight over it that it's been benefiting some more progressive candidates. Andy Kim was a part of that, but also even who won the mayoral race in Jersey City, because the AIPAC split the vote among non-progressive candidates by doing this. And when, say you're a lefty person and you see that ad against Malinowski, what are you going to do? Look up who the actual lefty is that stood up to Donald Trump. And Mejia benefited from that. I think also her work as an organizer, she really drove the numbers in Essex County, again, my hometown county, and turned out a lot of people, which, like, people like to be dismissive of door knocking and stuff like that. But her work in that area made them a major difference, and it was incredibly implausible. Because in fourth place was the guy, Brendan Gill. He was the Essex County machine Democrat who normally would have gotten this position on the ballot that would have been favorable prior to this legal challenge, where instead of grouping candidates by office, as ballots tend to do in New Jersey prior to 2024, they were grouping them by the party line. And the party line would be the Democratic machine in Essex County or in other areas of New Jersey putting their candidate forward. And that had, like, it made a major difference in privileging them on the ballot. It looks like, oh, this is the Democrat. This is the person you should support if you support these other candidates. And he came in fourth. So the candidate that AIPAC spent on to elevate came in third. The Democratic Party machine candidate came in fourth. And Malinowski had a lot of name recognition, but he was still kind of stuck in the middle. And Mejia looks like she could come in first here. So, I mean, it's just, it's really, really important. And this is not a commie corridor district by any means. I mean, there's a lot of homeowners. It's more affluent. But it means that perhaps this Democratic Tea Party is here. And if Mejia can win in that kind of district, lefties can win all across the country.
So we'll keep you updated on that count. In a moment, we'll be talking to Jeet Heer, national affairs correspondent at The Nation, host of the Time of Monsters podcast, and Dan Osborne later, independent candidate for U.S. Senate in Nebraska, who's most recent polls show him just about tied, if not statistically tied, with Pete Ricketts. But we're going to be talking to him about this Tyson plant in Lexington that is slated to close in just days now, I think. First, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Wild Grain. What is Wild Grain? It is almost too delicious to even talk about at this time of the day. I mean, honestly, like as soon as like I saw the ad and both, I was like, oh, this is the ad we're doing today. And both Brian and I were like, God, that was so good. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box. It provides for you artisanal breads, seasonal pastries, and fresh pastas. I had forgotten about that. I think they had a ravioli that was unbelievable. All of these items bake in less than 25 minutes. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients that you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. There's no preservatives, no shortcuts, except for you, because all you need to do is put it, preheat your oven to like 4 1/4, and you pop it in there. Some of the stuff takes 10 minutes, some of it takes 15, some takes 25. But the stuff is absolutely delicious. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, they have a vegan box, and now they have a new protein box. I had multiple loaves of bread One was like a rustic, bread, and Brian got a sourdough, and croissants. They give you free croissants in every box, and the croissants were just amazing. Saul and I, over the course of like 2 weeks, I made him a croissant sandwich. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so delicious. Apple cider donuts. I had some like pumpkin spice rolls. And it's delivered right to your door, super easy. Drop it right in the freezer and use it as you need. I mean, you could bring it over. You could bake fresh bread and bring it over as if you had actually like done it from scratch. There's nothing like having an artisan bakery in your own freezer to chase away the winter chill. Now's the best time to stay in and enjoy comforting homemade meals with Wild Grain. I highly recommend giving a Wild Grain a try. Right now, Wild Grain is offering our audience $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life. When you go to wildgrain.com/majority to start your subscription today, that's $30 off your first box, free croissants for life. When you visit wildgrain.com/majority, or you can use the promo code majority at checkout, we will put all of that information in the podcast and YouTube description, as well as at majority.fm. Quick break. When we come back, Jeet here. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program National Affairs correspondent, host of Time of Monsters podcast, Jeet here. Jeet, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be on the program.
Quite a bit of news this week, but arguably the biggest news, arguably. I mean, honestly,
I just want to contest that a little bit, because 60 Minutes had a repeat show of celebrity interviews, which to my mind indicates that there is not a lot of news, but continue.
And in fact, now that you mention that, the Daily from the New York Times today was "When Anesthesia Fails and the Patient is Cut Open." That was the what the Daily New York Times was.
Huh.
you know, there's not a lot going on.
Huh. Yeah.
All right, let's start with the Epstein yes. files, because this was the sort of the biggest drop we've seen, and it has ranged from implicating people with the sort of trafficking and to stuff about actually like Epstein's death with new revelations about that, and sort of the myriad of financial ties that Epstein has to not only things like Palantir and Peter Thiel, but also like in the founding of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and in like sort of the genesis of stuff coming out of 4chan. It's like,
it's crazy. It's like literally, you would not write this in a novel. I mean, I'm a big fan of Thomas Pynchon, who writes many novels of like a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of wacky stuff, actually a lot of like sex crimes. I don't think like this is actually like wilder than anything Pynchon has ever written, which is saying something. And yeah, it's almost, you know, like a James Bondian villain that somehow happens to be at the scene of every major crime of the last 30 years.
And we've seen like a series of resignations in Europe. Mm-hmm. We just saw a resignation in this country, a partner at one of the biggest law firms in the country had to resign.
Also, the head of the School of Visual Arts in New York, Ross. I don't know if you saw that, but
oh no, I didn't see that one. So let's. What do you think is the most? I guess it's hard to pick one, but give me your top two or three, like sort of like most important takeaways from what we now know about Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's the extent that the wealthy and powerful people that he already knew, who are already part of his network, they didn't mind the 2008 conviction, which was like for trafficking in minors. I mean, like that was like a pedophile accusation, which he got a slap on the wrist for. But I mean, like it is like he was convicted of that. And like none of these people, like Thiel, Musk, Reid Hoffman, a lot of elite figures throughout the world. So I think that it is quite remarkable the extent to which like these people were completely unruffled and were in fact like quite sympathetic. I mean, as someone who might be of interest to you is the former publisher of the New Republic, where I used to work, Marty Peretz, and he sent Epstein an email saying sorry I didn't write to you when this was all happening, but I'm glad that you're free now. By the way, I hit you up for some money for this Jewish archive that I'm supporting in New York, which Epstein did give money to. So I think that like the one big takeaway is what the crimes that Epstein was already known to have done by the world in 2008 were absolutely not a deal breaker for like a wide swath of the global elite. The other big takeaway is the exact nature of this elite, which there's all sorts of speculation. Was he a Mossad agent or a CIA agent? And I think I've been on before and I said, that's the wrong way to think about it. This guy was like, that's like a junior position. Like he is, an asset is not working with the former Israeli prime minister. This guy is a power player in the world, and the social world has a couple of nodes. One is Silicon Valley, like all those people, Thiel, Zuckerberg, Musk. The other node is New York financial world, the world of banking. The other node is sort of European politics, London being the sort of counterpart to New York. And then the other node is like these international connections he also had with oligarchs, Russian oligarchs, wealthy royal families in the Middle East, and of course the Israeli national security state. And that all of these, he is like a figure in that world, and he's kind of like the fixer or the connector that brings everyone together. I think one way to think about it is it's a sort of like classic figure whose talent is really just to be able to bring people together. There are people who are like good at partying and good, who know how to throw good parties.
There's a couple of things just to unpack those two. Like, first off, we still don't, as of yet, it does not appear that we have any more insight into how he got so rich. That is really unclear.
I think there's some little bit more clarity in some of the stuff I'm seeing, that he had sort of started off with the International Bank of Credit in the late 70s and early 80s, which is very interesting because that's
a very dirty, dirty bank.
Very dirty bank, and linked with like the CIA. And it also explains the interest that he and Bannon had in trying to influence Vatican politics, because as people might know, the Vatican Bank is actually like a major bank, and it actually has a lot of like power because it is like a national bank that is not like under any sort of democratic regular control. And there have been all sorts of scandals where it's been a sort of conduit for money trafficking. I think if you think of the
BCCI, they were a conduit in Iran-Contra.
Yes,
they were in Iran-Contra. All right, so we have like a vague notion, but it's still unclear. Like,
we know his affiliations,
but like, how did he?
But maybe Iran-Contra is the best place to start. I mean, and just like, well, one, understanding this informal network of elites that are actually calling the shots and breaking the laws of nation states and realizing we're like kind of transnational actors. We can operate above that. Mm-hmm. That's where intelligence comes in. But, you know, I mean, Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, was also involved in intelligence, KGB, and Mossad. He was arms dealing. And Jeffrey Epstein cut his teeth doing some arms dealing, too. So I think Iran-Contra is a really interesting place to start, where it's a big network of money laundering, financial ties to these big corrupt banks, and the national security state of a variety of different countries associated with the West.
Yeah. And actually, there's a direct echo of Iran-Contra in the recent stuff. During Iran-Contra, everyone knew that like the conduit for getting the weapons to Iran was Israel. And in all the reports, it was always referred to as third country. Third country was a euphemism for Israel and for Saudi Arabia, because they didn't want to name them. And it was very interesting that right now in England, Starmer, trying to defend himself, says, you know, if more stuff comes out, it could endanger security in the UK, the USA, and a third country.
Yes.
So guess who?
Yeah.
All right. So we have all these people who were not in any way hesitant, despite Epstein, you know, sort of getting a plea deal, I guess, for the 2008 stuff. Now, you know, there is a world where it's like, okay, you've served your time.
I just address that because, I mean, that is something that's actually like what, unfortunately, for me, tragically, Noam Chomsky said. And like, but I think that you serve your time only works if someone is like sufficiently punished. And you know, if you have someone who's like gets a slap on the wrist, then you can't say they serve their time, right?
And not only can't say that they've served their time, but it's quite clear that there is a, and I don't know about each individual, But a general awareness that this is not behavior that is stopped. This is not like a one-time thing, that there is like a systemic, like that's what this guy was known for, it seems like, throughout these circles. And everybody just sort of looked the other way. But the revelation of like how this guy was able to operate in this fashion, that his money opened up all these doors and he was creating all of these sort of like networks, there is a quality where we're starting to sort of get a notion of how they live, how these people live, sort of skipping above all of the constraints and capital constraints, legal restraints, social constraints. Yeah. They just sort of skate above it. Like, I've told this story many times before, but like I had a listener who had once ended up at a dinner party or like a fundraiser next to Robert Rubin. And Robert Rubin was complaining about the traffic in New York City. And he obviously wasn't driving himself. He was in the back of a town car or whatever it was. And he had called the assistant mayor to complain about the traffic. And this listener asked him, like, where were you? And he goes, I'm not sure. And like, he had no idea where he was in the city, because that's irrelevant. It's just like and the just the fingers that he had in so many different. It's almost unbelievable. I mean, it's almost like He's a fictional character just to express a dynamic.
Yeah. No. I mean, if he didn't exist, you would have to invent him. And I guess the whole sort of question is, who invented him? like, who found it, you know, it useful to create this guy? Because it was like, you know, this guy was like a you know, college dropout math teacher at a private school who suddenly, as you said, became very
wealthy. Father, Bill Barr, was the headmaster, we should say, at the Dalton School.
Yes,
And so, but do you think there was someone that created him?
I think that he took advantage of opportunities. And to go back to Emma's sort of point, this was like a period where there was a kind of like deregulation of institutions. And in part, I actually think, I mean, if we're taking the long historical view, I think that it was in response to the sort of attempt at democracy in the 1970s, where you had like a real church committee investigation into the CIA, real pushback to restrain the national intelligence state, you know, new rules that you can't just assassinate people. And the response to all that was like, well, why don't we just take the CIA off the books? Why don't we work with our friends who are arms dealers and bankers? And in that world, if you're someone who's like very good at connecting people, very good at, you can function very well. And this is where the sort of sex trafficking thing gets tied up, because the way, I mean, he was a pimp, and the way, you know, like, and that turns out to be a very good way of creating social networks, that you create this bond with other with rich, wealthy men. And you have the sort of the loyalty of transgression. Like if you know, like, you know, like at Skull and Bones, like how you're supposed to take off your clothes until all the worst thing that you've ever done. You have this bond of like, we've all committed this horrible, unspeakable crime together. Like, you know, like we're loyal to each other. We got to protect each other. And he was like within that environment where the national security state was going off the books. Someone like of his character was able to like, you know, fulfill the need that was done. But he didn't create the need. The need was created by like the broader social policies. I mean, like he's a product of Reaganism and the sort of 1990s neoliberalism.
The bond that's created, I think that's fascinating. You also, though, he had the backstop of filming everything. Like, he recorded everything. So the blackmail piece, I feel like you create the bond and then say things fall apart. Maybe you send yourself a draft email that you're going to be sending to Bill Gates and his number two about how you know certain things about him, and he probably has the ability to back that up. But what I guess is really disturbing to me is how that is a bond between these incredibly rich and powerful men, where like the idea that these men who have so much and can dominate the world like that try to replicate that and bond with the rest of this elite cabal through almost reenacting that with the most vulnerable person they can find, which is a sex trafficked child. And like that kind of says everything about what capitalism is. If that's almost, if you want to psychoanalyze it, it's replicating it. They're eroticizing their rapaciousness.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think the sexual thrill was partially one of sort of like domination and transgression. Like precisely they got thrilled by a sexual act that reconfirmed that they are the masters of the universe.
Yeah.
Sort of like these gods on earth beyond good and evil. I do actually think, I don't buy the conspiracy theory that Stanley Kubrick was killed, but I mean, that is actually the point of Eyes Wide Shut. Like that is actually what that movie is about. And so, yeah, I mean, like the national, I do want to emphasize the sort of like the national security state aspect of it, or the broader like economics is, I mean, he did have like a kind of like a worldview, and maybe like an even a worldview that kind of had different components or changed over time. Like I do see him in the sort of 1990s as being this kind of like Larry Summers, Bill Clinton, like globalist, you know, let's have trade, let's encourage STEM, let's have sexual liberalism. But what's interesting is like after his after he was arrested and got the slap on the wrist, like there was a kind of radicalization. And I think this radicalization we see in other people who also get sort of like Me Too'd, right? Like they suddenly think like, well, you know, I don't have to like follow any laws, right? And so there's a very interesting exchange between him and Peter Thiel where 2016, where Epstein says Brexit is just the beginning, and Thiel says of what? And I'm paraphrasing here, but like, you know, Epstein says, you know, the collapse of globalization, chaos, you know, this is something that we can profit off of because there'll be like many bargains. And he added, you know, like we both know that we both agree that even 0% interest rates weren't enough. So what he's saying there is like even the sort of like great deal that they had under like, you know, like Obama, 0% interest, which allowed them, you know, to make a lot of money. That wasn't enough. What you actually need is kind of like global chaos and things falling apart, because then you can actually pick up real bargains.
That also feels like.
Yeah. You want to run that through? Like it's that's actually a very crucial exchange.
Yeah.
Let's run this through. I also just want to ask, because I haven't been able to sort of like line up the timing. But this is also when Bannon was out there talking about the fourth turning.
Yes,
and
yes,
and which, you know, suggests that we're in this like sort of grand cycle where the world is going to be cast into turmoil. And I wonder like how much Epstein influenced Thiel's sort of like subsequent, you know, this is Weimar and people are tired of, I mean,
yeah.
Thiel was certainly down the road of being anti-democratic.
Thiel was sort of like already in that direction, but I think that the major turn was that they suddenly realized that chaos could be profitable. We also see this actually like in 2014 with his exchange with a banker, where he says, you know, like upheaval in Ukraine has many opportunities for us, or his exchange with Barack, where he says, you know, like Syria, he mentioned Ukraine and a few other places, saying like, you know, there's going to be a lot of desperate elites and this could be like good for business.
All right, let's go through this because it's interesting. And we should say that the equal signs here are just a function of like the sort of like taking the whatever the original formats they were in and putting them into sort of like files.
I think Epstein typed this way.
No.
Really?
I don't think so.
Yeah, no, it's a formatting error.
Oh, it is? Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. He had a lot of spelling errors, so...
He had a lot of spelling errors, and there's some that have also speculated that part of this might have been done in the formatting as a way of making it hard to search, although it doesn't make sense that way in my mind. But here it is. So Epstein writes to Peter Thiel, sort of unsolicited, on June 26, 2016, Brexit, just the beginning, please note. And then... Thiel writes back, of what? And Epstein, return to tribalism, counter to globalization, amazing new alliances. You and I both agree, zero interest rates were too high. And as I said in your office, AO, I'm not sure what that is, finding things on their way to collapse. Was much easier than finding the next bargain. And is that the end of the exchange?
So he's basically talking about the business opportunities. And it's the old sort of Silicon Valley model that you had in the Facebook era. You find this young upstart unicorn, you invest early, you make a lot of money. That's not working anymore. And so what you actually need is a world of tribalism and chaos, because that will drive the prices of businesses down, and then you can pick up bargains along the way.
I mean, this is all the sort of like, this is like post Iraq. It's like post, you know, it's the World War, post World War II. I mean,
shock
every
doctrine.
Yes, yeah, every shock every crisis ends up being an opportunity in this way. And it's interesting. Like, at what point does I mean? I've read, and it's sort of hard to sort of like parse between what you're reading is sort of conjecture or not, but it seems like Epstein was involved in helping create Palantir, or at least, you know, sort of like bring it into the next level.
Yeah.
And also, there's some, like, that he appears to have been heavily involved in the creation or the sort of acceleration of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think both fit into this like world of chaos, like model. Bitcoin with the idea that, like, you know, you want to undermine fiat money and the sort of, you know, control that nation states have over currency and create this alternative model. With Palantir, I mean, it's actually very funny because he introduces Ehud Barak to Thiel, and there's a, like an audio of this, and he's like, to go back to Emma's point about the spelling, like he's spelling out both Thiel and Palantir to Ehud Barak and getting the spellings completely wrong. Like this is like, whatever his talents were, they were not, he was not a spelling bee champion. But the idea was like, you know, like, so early sort of like investor encourager of Palantir, but especially with the Ehud Barak connection, you know, Israel, and he's like not just a former prime minister of Israel, but like former defense minister. Israel, you know, is the place where these technologies of surveillance and destruction are tested out. There is, you know, as a great book says, there's the Palestinian laboratory. You know, this is the, you know, the Gaza and the West Bank are research and development sites, you know, for the, you know, most destructive technologies on Earth. And then, you know, aside from the crimes against the Palestinians, what this allows you to do is to sell them, you know, and partially based on Israel's reputation for military prowess, you sell them to other countries around the world in Asia and Africa. Say, you know, like this is cutting edge Israeli surveillance technology. And so there's a tight connection between people like Peter Thiel and the Palantir people with the Israeli national security state, which it looks like Epstein like played a role in helping like set that up.
It's crazy. All right, let's now makes me wonder about Zelig with all the stuff with Woody Allen and
Woody Allen. Actually, I want to bring in the aspect of comedy because I saw that interview you did with Brace Belden, where he talked about how like Epstein was apparently like, we have photos of this. He's on the site of Woody's last few movies.
Oh yeah, he seems to have been very close to Woody Allen, going to the sets quite a bit.
What could they have in common?
He also seemed, I mean, you know, because I definitely want to get to this other topic here, but he weirdly did not seem to be too plugged in to Hollywood. Any way. I mean, he seemed to like comedians, and so he had a couple of dinner. And I will say happily, Marc Maron rejected the invite to the dinner.
Not canceled yet.
So he was like, I could definitely see Maron going like, oh, fuck that. I'm not going to.
Benefits of being a shut-in.
Exactly. I found that interesting, but I want to turn to the other sort of like major story of the week. Obviously, it is ICE, but there's sort of like a projecting out ICE as a vehicle in which to inhibit the election of 2026 and then ultimately 2028. The funding fight is happening right now. It appears that the Democrats made a rather weak ask in many respects, and certainly horrible from a messaging standpoint. But it was enough for the Republicans to sort of like say, no, we're not going to do this. But the Democrats don't get any of the messaging credit for it because they bungled this so badly, in my estimation. But you wrote that Gabbard's Georgia raid is a pretext for future election intimidation. How does that play out? I mean, there's reports now of like a big FBI meeting that's going to happen with election officials. Like, we don't know exactly, but it's things are starting to come into focus.
Yeah, no. I mean, this is like, you know, Trump has longstanding conspiratorial views of the 2020 election, which are not just about the past, but really are crucially about the future. that he, you know, he wants to make sure that he, you know, he and the Republicans don't lose again. So Tulsi Gabbard, who's like director of national intelligence, was supposedly brought in as an anti-war voice, but has been totally shut out of all decisions about Iran and Venezuela. But and is like, you know, goes to Georgia, which is not her remit. She's supposed to deal with international policies, and is you know, like part of this effort of seizing of voting records. I'll actually introduce, there's one foreign policy element, which I actually think that they're going to try to make a deal with Maduro, because Trump has said that he thinks that Maduro was involved with like the voting machines. So I can see where, like, you know, they say, you know, like Maduro, like, you know, like you just confess that you helped Joe Biden steal the 2020 election, and we'll let you off. And you can even
Sidney
go back.
Powell was like floating this Venezuela connection for 6 years ago now, yeah, in 2020. And
Trump cited it like for the invasion of Venezuela. Like this is like one of the rationales for kidnapping a foreign head of state.
And how do we know how Maduro was able to sway the 2020 election? Like,
I thought it was the ghost of Hugo Chavez that they kept saying. They kept saying it was Chavez who was
maybe
dead.
Chavez was not really dead, and he was like around the country in like an RV, messing with voting machines.
I'll confess, I don't know the exact details of this insane theory. Although I think it does involve voting machines. I think that's exactly right. That there's some sort of speculation that the voting machines were made in Venezuela. But certainly the fact that you have Maduro in custody and you have Donald Trump, who's like, you know, been known to give pardons and amnesties to people who like say the right thing, you know, that creates an interesting opportunity. And you have Bannon out there saying, you know, like we can send in ICE agents at voting stations. So I do actually think that like, there's, you know, at least a faction within the Republican Party that really wants to do this, and they have Trump's ear. And I have to say, like, from the point of view of the Democrats, like, you know, like in terms of like all the weak messaging, like ICE is already unpopular. And if you like, you know, say that this is going to be used as a tool for electoral repression, and we have like Trump's former White House advisor saying this, like, you know, like that gives you like a political vantage point for like opposing like ICE in a way that I don't think Chuck Schumer is willing to do. But
it's, I mean, I know you guys talked about it yesterday, but it is absolutely just mind blowing how just bad they are at this in terms of messaging. I mean, they're clearly, Chuck Schumer and Jeffries are clearly afraid of the potential of like some ICE agent not wearing their mask, their name being, you know, thrown around online, and somebody coming and, you know, shooting that ICE agent. And somehow Schumer and Jeffries are held responsible in some fashion for that. As if, like, A, if that happened, ICE seems to be very universally hated at this point by just about everybody who's ever going to hate ICE. B, the problem would be the shooting, not that Jeffries and Schumer were somehow like, they're not going to be like, they're not going to have immunity from the political accusation that they
refrain from like accusing the Democrats of this because they're like, oh yeah, no, the Schumer and Jeffries.
They did have special circumstances, and so therefore we can't. Donald Trump said, "I can't blame them. They did the right thing." Like it's just absurd.
I just think perhaps though it's more than just like the ideological piece. I just don't think that we can be gloss over, just because even the reforms that they're so inclined to propose, the body camera stuff we've talked about, that like a lot of people in ICE and DHS actually really like body cameras because they can choose when they put out body camera footage and not. They can bury it. They have control over the footage more than if you have observers out there with 10 different angles on Preddy's killing. And that's the thing that, like, you know, Cory Booker came out immediately after Renee Good's killing and was like, more body cameras, more body cameras. They are not willing this leadership cadre or whatever, this class of Democrat, to fundamentally like reform, to cut into ICE's budget, it appears, at all. Even though I would say a majority, it seems like, of House Democrats are saying we should make that a part of the ask to claw that back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if one were to give them credit, like maybe they think that they are these sort of swing districts where ICE is an issue and you have to support the Democrats that are there or the Democrats that could win. But I don't actually think that's even true. Yeah,
it's not true. Polling,
yeah. Well, like ICE is like overwhelmingly unpopular among independents, right? Like these, I think it's just like, you know, it's a class of older elected officials that have, you know, like a mentality where it's always like 1993 or it's always 2003. Like they are not aware of the present moment. And yeah, they're not willing to have this sort of like fight. I mean, I think that Chuck Schumer's whole political life has been an environment where like it always made political sense to support the police funding. That's what the Baileys wanted. And I don't think he realizes, you know, the Baileys are in a retirement home. They're not going to vote anymore.
And I wish I made this point yesterday, but when you have Schumer and Jeffries coming out there and saying no masks except for in very specific circumstances, because what Schumer said was, what if there's a terrorist that's trying to kill an ICE agent? Maybe that does make Sam's point stronger. Like, oh, that's, if only, I'm glad we're not in a situation where the administration is classifying anybody that disagrees with them as a terrorist. Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
I'm so glad we're not in that. Oh, wait, we are in that situation.
That's how they arrested Don Lemon. It was the NPSM 7. And according to that same document, anybody who is arguing against ICE is a terrorist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, they've been cases like down in Texas of, you know, protesters who might have actually, you know, committed what are normally criminal acts where they'd be prosecuted, but like it's up to the level of terrorism, which it clearly is not. It's a very disturbing thing. And yeah, I mean, like Schumer and Jeffries are basically validating some of Trump's worst impulses. They're giving like ideological cover for this. But I mean, like, you know, this is something we've talked about before. Like, I don't think like any sort of political progress is going to come from that faction. They need to be deposed. I think, you know, the positive thing is they're good signs that the party's heading elsewhere. As we just saw with the special, with the primary in New Jersey last night. So, yeah. I mean, you're going to need a leadership change before things get better.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the case. It is. It's just impressive to watch this level of, it's just incompetence. I mean, it's just a political incompetence. Like even if I at least in the context of DHS, I just think that like, if you're going to ask for masks not to be worn, which I think you should, because in my mind, you can cut funding. They're going to move funding around. They're never going to have a funding problem. I feel like they could lose 50% of their budget right now, and they'd still be fine. All they're doing is just giving it out in contracts for detention centers. They have so much money, they don't even know what to do with it. They don't have the mechanism in which to deploy it properly. But on a like a very real basic level, if these ICE agents had to go around showing their faces, I think they would feel extraordinarily naked and unprotected.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so,
well, I mean, ICE already has a sort of morale problem. There are people quitting left and right because, you know, it's not a good job if you're going out there and ordinary Americans are like yelling and swearing at you because they hate you. So, Schumer, I mean, it is political malpractice, but it's malpractice because on this issue, as others, like Schumer and Jeffries fundamentally agree with Trump. Like their worldview is, like, you know, Trump's going too far. He's incompetent in how he's enacting these policies, but the policies themselves are right. And I think that the line we have to take is like, no, you should not have the federal government have like its own Gestapo force, which is used for political purposes against Americans, whether they're documented or not. Like, it's just like it's unacceptable.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of, like, I don't know if you paid any attention to this Ron Wyden thing, lastly. Ron Wyden issued a letter to... To Ratcliffe, saying, hey, just want to bump up the urgent letter about a horrible matter that I sent you the other day.
About which was just CIA basically activities, plural.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, I'm sure you remember from the NSA spying era, Wyden sort of issued similar sort of like second order smoke signals, like something's really up. I can't talk about it, but I want everybody to be paying attention here and digging around.
I don't like have any like inside scoop. I mean, it seems to be Gabbard related. I think we can be pretty confident about that, which leads me to think it's related maybe to the stuff about Georgia that we talked about. There has also been some speculation that it might also be related to Gabbard's, the strange sort of religious organization that she's part of and which seems to have a sway.
No way.
I've heard that. Like, I don't know anything more than what you guys know.
And so you think it is Gabbard related as opposed to, say, like Venezuela? Because what's the CIA doing?
Venezuela and Gabbard are not two different things, right? Like, I do actually think that they want to make Maduro basically say, you know, Donald Trump should have won that Nobel Prize. And you have the full spectrum of Venezuelan society supporting Trump getting the Nobel Prize. And also, by the way, I and the ghost of Hugo Chavez conspired to elect Joe Biden.
That would be the connection, right? CIA would be the ones making that deal with Maduro.
Yes, yes, yes. And that this would justify, like, you know, having like the FBI and ICE take over the voting stations at, you know, Fulton County, Georgia, you know, which is like where the election is going to be settled in just a few months time. So I do think that this is like, you know, like, I don't want to put this as absolutely factual, but you know, like based on all the different stories that are happening and the parts that are in motion, that seems to be a likely guess.
Jeet here, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, host of Time of Monsters podcast. I suspect we'll be talking about this with you again soon. As always,
thanks so much. The fun never stops, Sam.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't mind it if it did for a little bit, to be honest with you. But Jeet here, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
It's always great to be on the program.
Thanks,
Jeet. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dan Osborne, independent candidate for the U.S. Senate in Nebraska, currently tied in the polls, more or less, to the extent that we know the polling, to talk to us about the recent closure of a Tyson plant in Lexington, Nebraska. 3,200 people lost their job in a town of 11,000. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Dan Osborne, independent candidate for the U.S. Senate in Nebraska. Dan, welcome to the program.
No, thank you for having me on. It's good to be here.
This is your second run at this seat. You came relatively close last time. I want to speak to you about what's taken place in this Tyson plant. We actually have some footage of Pete Ricketts addressing this. But before we do, Just tell us a little bit about yourself, why you decided to run for the Senate.
Yeah, so I suppose I'm just a regular guy who likes to drink beer and watch football, right? And I haven't always been political. It really wasn't until I was president of my union during COVID. And what happened there was Kellogg's struck, my union struck Kellogg's because of we were fighting for our wages and our benefits, and that, you know, made me political. I suppose it opened my eyes to the political world and the fact that this is, you know, where I'm at. And shoot, so let's move on to the next question.
Sure. I mean, no, that's and I think, you know, just taking a people ever take a moment to head over to your website and take a look at your platform. A lot of that is indicative of an economic populism that I think, you know, a lot of what unions are meant to do. A lot of your positions here are extensions of that. Give us a sense of like what your experience has been in the context of Nebraska. I know I've spent a little bit of time in Lincoln and Omaha back years and years ago, but give us a sense of like, you know, what the dynamic has been in that state and what you see as sort of like the primary, I guess, a problem with that dynamic.
Yeah, well, you know, I've done 200 public events in 2024, advertised, right? Like I go out and I talk to Nebraskans every day. We're continuing to do that. I've probably done close to 40 of them now. Hopefully we'll get 250 publicly advertised events where we go out and we meet every day people, you know, that go and punch a clock for a living or whatever it is they do, nurses, teachers, truck drivers, plumbers, get out there and meet them where they're at. And what I'm finding is most people, whether they're Republican or Democrat, especially once we dive deep, you know, do a deep dive into the issues, we all agree on so much, right? And it's frustrating to see, you know, we all plug into the news, we all get on our phones, and we're bombarded with all this information. But the reality on the ground is we agree on so many things. And so what I try to do is I try to focus on the things that we agree on. And what we agree on is the fact that, you know, the economy and affordability and paychecks, because I work for a company called Grunwald Mechanical. I'm a steam fitter. I get a paycheck every week. I know how much comes in. I know how much goes out. And all of these policy issues, whether it's tariffs or, you know, especially in the ag sector, you know, with row crop farmers and beans, what's happening is we are seeing it's harder to live, right? And so many things go into that in healthcare. So the commonality between all of those things is the consolidation of our industries. And so we have, you know, antitrust and anti-monopolies laws on the books. And so that I suppose that's the basis of everything is fighting this monopoly in the consolidation of our industries and ag specifically. It's, you know, farmers when they purchase their inputs, you're talking about seed and you're talking about chemicals, they have to buy from monopolies. And then when they have their production at the end of the year, they have to sell to monopolies. And that again goes into also healthcare. It's gone all the way down into even to youth sports, this consolidation of industries. So that's something that I want to fight for to break up, because I think that is the basis, the derivative of this affordability problem that we're all experiencing.
I will say too, you're probably the only candidate in the country who has right to repair in the top five of their issues. And that obviously is because, you know, a lot of farmers and folks who want to be able to fix their vehicles, fix their equipment. And increasingly, warranties are voided. If you don't have, if you're not using necessarily factory, parts or factory service. I mean, I think that's indicative of a lot of what you're talking about in terms of those.
Well, yeah. I mean, you nailed right on the head, right? If you own something, you should have the right to repair it. It goes to consumer protection laws is something that I'm very interested in as well. It goes to the fact that, I mean, you could talk about printers, right? Something as simple as a printer. It's almost cheaper to buy a new printer than it is to buy the ink for the printer. And it goes back to our phones. You used to be able to take the back of your phone off and replace the battery for $50, and then it was good for another 2 years. And now, you know, you have to buy a new $1,000 phone every 2 years. It's this planned obsolescence.
Yep.
That these corporations do. And that absolutely goes into being able to pay your bills and live a comfortable life. And that's something that I want to fight for. I want to go to the U.S. Senate to do. And quite frankly, my opponent, Pete Ricketts, he's a Nepo baby, right? He comes from his dad is a billionaire. He started TD Ameritrade, which sold out to Charles Schwab. And so he's never had to experience what it's like to put Christmas on a credit card or try to figure out how to replace something in your vehicle yourself because you can't afford to take it to a mechanic. Those are the things that our lawmakers in Congress don't understand, because here's the facts. Less than 2% of our elected officials in both the House and Senate come from the wage earning class, right? The people like us who, go to work and punch a clock every day. So of course they don't get it. So that's something I want to give the people who don't have a voice in Congress a voice. That's why we're doing this every day.
You mentioned Pete Ricketts. Let's talk about this Tyson plant. I guess it was sometime in November. Tyson announced that they were going to close down this processing plant. It employs, if I remember correctly, something like 3,200 people in a town, Lexington, Nebraska, of about 11,500, and which, of course, you know, directly employs, I would imagine, that another, half of the people, again, some are kids, who have jobs, have those jobs because they're selling to people who work there. Like the entire economy, obviously, is completely a function of that. They're closing the plant not because it sounds like they're closing the plant as a way of constraining supply so that they can increase their markup, make the same amount, if not more, profits on less expenditures, which I imagine, and you might know more than I, is simply a way for people in the C-suite to make more money because they have stock options, and that's where they're going to get paid, is the rate of profit, as opposed to, sort of like just the revenue in general. Walk us through what you would do about this and what you think should be done.
Yeah, so it's a pretty clear case that Tyson is manipulating prices, right? That 3 weeks ago, they just paid an $82 million lawsuit for this exact same thing. It happened 20 years ago in North Fork, Nebraska. They shut down a plant. And what happens is they don't sell it to a competitor. They actually poured concrete down the drain, and that plant still sits there today, empty. Weeds growing everywhere around it. So what they're doing in Lexington is the same thing. And we are a nation of laws, right? I think everybody understands that. And this all started at the turn of the century, around 1900. with the robber barons, you know, carving up the country for themselves. Over, you know, 90% of Americans, the wealth has transferred from 90% of Americans to the top 1%. We're experiencing that again today. What did they do about it in the 1900s? Well, they created antitrust and anti-monopoly laws. And so we have the Packard and Stockyards Act in 1921, which is what, you know, I've tried to hold Tyson's feet to the fire on, as far as, you know, the what that law says is if you close a plant, then you should have that plant available to sell to a competitor. And they are not doing that. They are going to mothball this plant. So they are trying to manipulate the market and the prices. So what that means, if you, you know, do a little bit of a micro dive into it, it means the producers or the ranchers who are actually finally making decent money for the, you know, the product that they raise, they're going to make it so they're not going to make as much money. And then the consumers, which is us, when we go to the grocery store, which we're all experiencing, I haven't bought beef in probably 6 months. Like I just walk right on by it because I just can't afford it anymore. So that's what's happening. And Tyson knows this, and they are continuing to enrich themselves because corporations, they have one goal in mind, right? And that's profit. And that's to get their CEOs and their board, enrich them as well as enrich their stockholders. That's their main reason for existence, I suppose. So I'm for the workers. I have unapologetically have a workers platform, pro-worker platform. I want to be for these people. And what's happening, you mentioned 3,200 jobs in Lexington. It's not just the 3,200 people that are affected. It's the entire town. I mean, you figure all the grocery stores, the gas stations, the car dealers, all these people are going to suffer. In fact, $1 billion per year is going to be taken out of Nebraska. So that's huge. So I went there and I did a press conference to highlight this issue, especially, you know, the antitrust issue that they're violating. And then so what that prompted Pete Ricketts, my opponent, to come on and say, hey, I'm going to look into this, guys, right? Like, yeah, I'm going to look into it. The day after he announced he was going to look into it, he got a donation from Tyson. And now he's totaled $72,000 from Tyson. And now, after looking into it, he's found that Tyson is not in violation of any law, which is complete BS. So that's where
we're
at.
Let's check in with him. This is a clip of him being asked by, is it DropSite? DropSite reporter about that Tyson plant.
Senator Ricketts, a couple months ago, you said that you were going to look into whether Tyson was violating the Packers and Stockyards Act, but now 3,300 people have lost their jobs. So I'm wondering what exactly you did to try to save that plant.
So they are not violating the Stockyards and Packyards, right? But I've been to Lexington to work with the mayor about being able to use that facility to continue to create jobs. So we're going to be working with Tyson. They're talking about, they're doing an evaluation of what they're going to continue for. But there's valuable resources there with regard to the land, the railroad spur, and the wastewater plant that can be used for future jobs.
But what did you do to try to save it before it closed down?
So, again, this is one of the things where we have a private sector.
Oh, boy, that...
An elevator door couldn't close fast enough for him there, huh?
You could not have scripted that better. I mean, like you say, there was plenty. It seems like he very conveniently looked into this, like when it was a done deal. And now he's talking about there being valuable resources there. There was also a valuable resource in the sense that there was a plant. And we should also say, not only is it impacting that town, but you make the point that, you know, there were suppliers to Tyson here. And when there are fewer buyers of that meat product, suddenly the buyer gets a lot more power. it's monopsony power in that instance, but they then have the ability to dictate and to drive down prices for them, which, of course, it does not appear that they're going to pass it on to the consumer in any way. And again, raising their profits. Do you have a sense when he says, like, there's valuable resources there, the land? That sounds like it's a valuable resource for Tyson. But do you have any sense of, like, what he's talking about in terms of helping the people in that town? Like, he's met with the mayor. That's very sweet. But
there's no making sense of what he said. I work for a corporation for 20 years. I work for Kellogg's, and I heard CEOs and plant managers talk that mumbo jumbo buzzword, corporate buzzword speak, where you say a bunch of stuff without actually out saying or not saying anything. And that's exactly what he did there. The bottom line is, you know, especially in regards to Tyson, they're breaking the law. Everybody knows they're breaking the law. And again, they account for 5% of the beef production in this country, just in Lexington, Nebraska. That's huge. Wow. So this is obviously a clear case of price fixing. It's what they're going to do. You know, we can have a class action lawsuit, which we're trying to do right now to get enough producers together or employees to create this class action lawsuit. And Tyson will pay out just like they did 3 weeks ago with $82 million. But, the
it's
DOJ.
It's the cost of doing business for them.
Yeah, it's the cost of doing business. The DOJ and the FTC and our federal delegation here in Nebraska, they need to be holding these corporations accountable for, you know, consolidating the industries and price fixing. We're seeing it in every aspect of our life. And I think this is a fight worth fighting. Everybody should be interested in this and paying attention to it.
What are you hearing from farmers, ranchers in Nebraska about what the biggest challenges that they're facing right now? I mean, maybe it's hard to disaggregate corporate consolidation from the general struggles, but I would imagine that the tariffs and those increases have been especially difficult during the past year.
Yeah, big time. I just spoke with a row crop farmer. Actually, soybean. He had soybeans this year. His name is Bill. I'm not going to say his last name. Because most people in Nebraska are Republican and conservative, and he's no different. But so what Bill told me was, I asked him about the $12 billion bailout that President Trump has for our farmers. And I asked him, I said, is that going to help save your farm, essentially? And he said, no. What it is that $12 billion, and it's noteworthy to say that we've given Argentina $40 billion, yes, right, in bailouts for them when our farmers are getting 12. I'm not a mathematician, but that doesn't add up. But what he was saying is that's going to help him, you know, for next year to buy his seed and to buy the chemicals that he's going to need to plant his crop next year. But what it does for him this year is nothing. So what we're going to see is bankruptcies at a massive scale. We're going to see farmers that cannot stay in business because companies like John Deere have manipulated prices on their tractors. I mean, $1 million combines. Like, this is insane. And they can't even fix their own equipment, right? Like, they are just getting bombarded left and right by these corporations, whether it's Syngenta, which is a Chinese-owned seed corporation that has formed a monopoly around that. Like, they have to buy their inputs from monopolies and sell their exports to monopolies. And what's going to happen, he told me, is, you know, he's got enough saved up and he's got enough kids working on his farm that they're going to be able to hold, you know, save it. But a lot of people are going to have to file for bankruptcy. Who's going to come in and buy them up? Private equity, right? And we're going to continually see this consolidation of our agriculture. And look, 2%, less than 2% of Americans feed the rest of us. We have to protect our farmers. It is so imperative that we get ahead of this before it's too late. And I mean, it's so important. That's why, you know, my opponent, Pete Ricketts, he's on the side of the corporations, right? That's who he is. And he's what's fundamentally wrong with politics in this country. And the amount of money that it takes to run for office is, you know, I think one of the most important issues of our time is getting money out of our politics and just going back to the constitutionality of by a government by and for the people. And right now, it's a government for the 1% and the corporations.
Well, we should tell you we're getting a message from our resident farm reporter in the Grand Island area. He says, Kowalski from Nebraska, from the Kowalski farm. Please let my future senator know that I've been spreading the good word of Osborne in the Grand Island area, and most people are responding with positivity or pure hatred toward Pete. I have always been getting my fellow cattle producers on board with nationalizing and subsequently operating the meatpacking plants like the post office. Where can people go to get more information if they want to help you out, if they're in the Nebraska or neighboring states, I guess, to come help with volunteering, or if they want to support you in other ways, where should they go online?
Yeah, I mean, you go to osborneforsenate.com. It's O-S-B-O-R-N. I don't have an E at the end of my name, like the famous coach. Unfortunately, no relation there. Arguably one of the greatest college football coaches in history. We have a rich football history. And we know we're living in an upside down world, right? When Indiana is now a football school and Nebraska is a basketball school. Like, what is happening? But I'll take it. I love Nebraska sports. I love the university, and you know, yeah, we're kicking some butt in some basketball and volleyball. And but I love that. Yeah. But yeah, osborneforsenate.com.
All right. We will put a link to that at in the podcast and YouTube descriptions and at majority.fm. Dan Osborne, thanks so much for coming on. Good luck with your race. Maybe we'll check in the coming months. Really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you guys, too. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have fun.
No side deals.
No side deals will happen in the fun half today. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get to IMS in the fun half, and you help this show survive and thrive in a rather tumultuous era for, well, just about everybody. Some worse than others.
Like how when water circles a drain, it's tumultuous.
Exactly. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Support this co-op in Madison, Wisconsin. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
How the fuck am I even supposed to sell this property?
Sorry, I just wanted Jacobin show today.
I didn't realize how intense he was about that.
I mean, it's the one. He gets really animated over his assets, especially when you lose an income stream. Jacobin show aired this morning, 10 a.m. We had Robin Wansley back on talking about what Democrats can do both on a local level and if they're socialist or progressive, tap in to fight this ICE stuff. Above and beyond what sort of the Fry and Walls types are doing. And Chip Gibbons talking about how Seth Harp is getting in trouble for journalism, which is now being redefined as doxing.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, Seth, whatever's happening with Ross Douthat is hilarious.
Oh, my God.
It seems like for people that aren't as online as me, the New York Times' Ross Douthat did a debate with Seth Harp about foreign policy.
Challenged him.
yeah.
to a debate. And then they had it.
And it seems as if that debate has been buried. And Seth has some texts from like the immediate aftermath of the debate, like that he sent to, his editor and stuff, saying it went really poorly for Ross. I did quite well. And I mean, Seth is obviously like,
well, now that
why would they bury it?
No, I mean, they wrote to him and told him.
They were pivoting
they
away.
They said, we were doing the editing and we couldn't make it work. And so we're pivoting away. Let me tell you how ridiculous that response is. First off, it's one thing to say we had a piece that we were going to run on our finite amount of television space we have for this program. You know, like not everything that, you know, we can't fit everything into this show because right. we have a finite amount of show.
Right.
There is an infinite amount of space on the internet. You've already shot the thing. Editing a two-person interview, Brian, I know you've done some editing.
Yes.
Are there times where you're like, gosh, I wish we had some B-roll here, or why didn't we take a picture of like somebody's isolation on somebody's hands, you know, so we could cut away to this shot or something like it's yeah.
well,
what?
No, it's very simple to edit a two-shot interview.
It's maybe like we couldn't make the edit work. Like what?
Then release the raw footage. We don't need to even see like fully. You don't need to do the side. I know it's very important for the New York Times to have both the profile of Ross and then apparently the side profile and then cutting in between like they do with Ezra. But maybe just pick one shot and release the audio so we can see for ourselves.
There are like... Saul has editing programs on his phone that would just do it automatically.
Yeah, AI does that.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Dross Douthat in the editing room with his editors.
This screenshot is not specific. Oh, I see it.
Understand, Mr. Snippy Snip.
That's in Succession when Greg tells...
I think he just wants like a... Welcome, I'm Ross Douthat, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, just cobbled together Seth saying, you make a good point, I respect the military. Yeah.
What is Greg cutting up here in this clip?
This is when they edit for that Life Plus thing to make it work, where it looked like the dead dad. Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry.
supported, yeah.
It supported the new investment.
I think in a show called Succession, there's no spoiler alert saying the dad died.
It's only been 2 years. Yeah. All right. We'll get to take a quick break. Fun half.
Yeah, fun half. Here we go.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts! Wait a second, hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Fun half. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey!
Fun half. Matt!
Who?
Fun half.
What is up, everyone?
Fun half. Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun half.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun half. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start off.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We're back. Holy Cross, is that what you said? I was just saying, like, I didn't have the heart to break it to Dan Osborne. I'm like, Indiana, yeah, I saw that movie, Hoosiers, right? And I'm from the Northeast. Like, you know.
Celtics.
The closest we came to even, like, college sports being venerated was probably Holy Cross in 1972, before the Big East was formed, was one of the first colleges asked to be in the Big East. They said no. And then I guess Boston College, when Doug Flutie was there, it was sort of a big deal.
UMass, I was going to mention that as a joke.
How about BC hockey? And
UMass Amherst had a like the 90s. I think they made the Final Four.
But it's just not like it's just not. If you grow up in the Northeast, college sports are just sort of like
maybe UConn you're into, but for the most part,
UConn for secondary. Sure.
Yeah, there's some Jersey Rutgers fans, but it's I mean, come on, let's get serious here.
I went to a Division III college, and we were not even – we were, like, really Division IV.
What?
We were really, like, Division IV.
Oh, yeah.
What should we get to here? There's a lot of stuff.
Dude.
I like the Mamdani thing.
Oh, yes. We should play this. Mamdani gave a press conference today. We don't know the exact details on this. But he's making a very distinct. This was at the interfaith breakfast, but he's speaking specifically about ICE. And here he is. This was about 3 hours ago, 2 hours ago, making it very, very clear that where he stands in terms of, you know, what steps New York City is prepared to take in the event that they see any type of like ICE surge like we've seen in Minneapolis. And we should say, well, let's play this first.
And that is why this morning, right here in this moment, I shall sign an executive order that will uphold our city's protection, not just of our fellow immigrant New Yorkers, but of all New Yorkers, from abusive immigration enforcement.
Pause it for 1 second. Is that me, or is he trying to sort of like subtly either mock or emulate Donald Trump? Because I don't ever remember executive orders being held up with like this, except for Donald Trump. And now maybe it's happened in other places. And on some level, like he may be thinking like, he can sell it to Trump like it's an homage to him in some way. I mean,
well, he didn't use the Sharpie that Trump would normally use.
That
is a very
that would
light
be upstage.
Don't respect
signature.
That pen.
No, right. You can't. That's
You have a very thin pen. You knew you didn't
little
upstage
tiny pen.
My thick pen.
I can't read that in 480p.
But let's listen to what he, what, you know, it's tough to glean exactly what this means, but I think there are some clues in there, at least how he intends to carry this out.
This order is a sweeping reaffirmation of our commitment to our immigrant neighbors and to public safety as a whole. We will make it clear once again that ICE will not be able to enter New York City property without a judicial warrant. That means our schools, our shelters, and our hospitals. That means we will protect New Yorkers' private data from being unlawfully accessed by the federal government and stand firmly against any effort to intrude on our privacy. No New Yorker should be afraid to apply for city services like childcare because they are an immigrant. This order mandates that essential city agencies are complying with city laws and directs them to conduct thorough audits of all policies guiding agency interactions with immigration authorities. And it will establish an interagency response committee so that in the event of a major crisis, we are ready and equipped to do the job of protecting New Yorkers. We will create a centralized mechanism for coordinating policy across agencies so that government speaks with one voice in times of need. City Hall will not look away. But we need our faith leaders with us.
Okay.
Your moral clarity.
He says ICE can't enter places without judicial warrants. And again, you know, sort of like the implication or is that New York City police are going to uphold these laws. Schools, shelters, hospitals cannot be entered without a warrant. They're going to protect data. In other words, they are not going to share any information. I mean, this is key, particularly across the board, but when you're talking about public safety, you do not want large segments of the population to be afraid to report a crime, to report a fire, to get assistance that they are legally entitled to get an education for kids, because it's bad for the entire city.
Well, he's,
when these people don't, are discouraged,
yes,
or afraid to engage with these services.
It's bad for public safety. He said this before. I'm trying to restore trust in government. And what the Trump, when he was saying, you know, why we should abolish ICE, what the Trump administration is doing is creating people afraid of their government, where they show up to their immigration hearing and they could be, even though they're trying to do the process the right way and they're interacting with government, they could be nabbed up and kidnapped and thrown into some sort of concentration camp on that basis. And he's also trying to make it clear where, like, you know, he hasn't gotten pushback for when he said that his universal child care program is going to apply to immigrants too. I mean, way at Fox News and the New York Post, they'll bitch and moan, but I haven't seen it more broadly because he says it forcefully. And that's what he's trying to say here too, is like, these programs that I'm trying to implement, therefore you too, I will have your back.
And then the last thing that really struck me was this interagency response for major crises. He's also like saying, we're going to speak with one voice. So there may be segments of city services that are more inclined to be pro-ICE than others. But no, you're going to speak with the same message that comes from City Hall. But interagency response to a major crisis to protect New Yorkers. Now, I imagine we already have interagency emergency response teams for things like a terror attack,
mm-hmm,
for things like flooding, for things like a major storm. I think when he's talking about crisis, He's talking about what we've seen happen in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and that there is not going to be New York City police doing one thing and firefighters doing another thing and some detective bureau or even maybe FBI or whatnot. Like, I mean, he can't control federal authorities, but he can say to NYPD, you're not cooperating in this. And in fact, if there's like a major protest or something, your job is to protect New Yorkers. So we'll see, but it's good to see that he is being very explicit about it right now. Now, we should also say he just came out with an endorsement for Governor Hochul.
Yeah.
And he wrote a piece that is in The Nation magazine. I think it's worth reading what, and I think it's something that we anticipated he was going to do, because there was clearly, they have made a deal about his priorities, which he needs Hochul to help him with, the least, not the least of which is, was universal child care. There's no funding mechanism for that yet, at least a year or two out in terms of increase in taxes. But it sounds like, you know, this is all part of that process. And the thing that I think people should appreciate about this, you can disagree with it from a strategic standpoint, he is addressing it directly, like literally showing his work. This is not a secret deal. He's laying it out there in the pages in The Nation magazine. There's a lot of things he disagrees with about Hochul, but he needed her help to do this. And
that's all we care. I mean, he's brought her to heel. When is the last time that we've seen that with like a, well, we've had so few left victories, but he's brought her to heel. He's going to, he seems to have some assurances from her on how his agenda is going to be funded. It stinks because I think the Delgado primary challenge, if it played itself out more for a little bit longer, could have been quite healthy. And I think Delgado has a lot of strengths as a candidate. But Hochul got ahead out of this because she saw where the winds were blowing. And that's really what we want. We don't need our leaders to necessarily have like the exact ideology that we have. We just need them to be responsive in the way that we want them to be. And it seems like Mamdani thinks he has a partner in her in that regard. The other thing I didn't hear, I'm not sure if he said it explicitly, but I'm just glancing over like the his website's write-up of his address here. Initiating an audit to make sure city agencies are complying with sanctuary laws.
Yes.
That was, I guess you touched on it a bit, but that's really, really interesting because that makes it see that's him saying internally, if you're not complying and you're a collaborationist with ICE, like we are going to have some sort of internal monitor that looks at you. That's signaling to cops.
This is not just to cops, but also to all sorts of like assistance programs, et cetera, et cetera. It is basically in the same way that the Trump administration went through and started saying, like, you know, give us any program that has the word, you know, equity in it. We're going to cut that. They're going through and making sure that there is no, that everything is buttoned up. There is no back door. There is no side door. There is no request that you will get from the federal government, regardless of agency, that you will fulfill unless it's quite clear that that data is going to be protected. Somebody's asking on the IM, the executive order is nice, but the majority of ICE actions in New York City have been arrests of immigrants when they go to their mandated interviews or hearings at Federal Plaza. Does this do anything to stop that? I don't know, but my guess would be there's no way to do that. There's no New York City does not have jurisdiction in a federal building. And so I would be very surprised if there's anything that the that New York City can do within that building. I think the bottom line is this is about what we've seen in Minneapolis, which is on the streets, going into people's houses, going into schools, going into hospitals. I just, without knowing for sure, but I would be very, very surprised if there's anything the city can do once somebody walks into a federal building.
And he is making the case for sanctuary city laws, and he has been for quite a while. Would have been nice for any Democrat for the past, I don't know, 5 years when you heard this hysteria about sanctuary city laws from the right to stand up there and give an explanation as to what they actually mean, which is like protecting your neighbor from being scooped up.
Things Republicans know nothing about. Like, we run big cities here. You need to have trust in public safety and the authorities empowered to do that. We're not going to listen to some idiot from Alabama about sanctuary cities being bad.
Nassau County spokesperson says the grassroots org seem to be in for Delgado. There's still a chance. Delgado just named India Walton his running mate. She was elected the Democratic nominee for mayor in Buffalo. You'll recall, I feel like 4 years ago. And the existing mayor, who'd been there for a long time, ran as an independent. The Democratic apparatus supported him. She did not win. So Delgado's out there. And personally, I will probably vote for Delgado. And I think his running continues. There is no doubt that if Delgado was not in this race and had not declared when he did, Mamdani would not have the leverage they would have had. If Hochul had the entire left lane to herself, Mamdani would not have had leverage.
Yeah, and there's a quote from Jabari Brisport, a state senator, also DSA supported. Even Zoran gets it wrong sometimes, according to Brisport, but he also, the next paragraph, still he didn't linger on Mamdani's decision, pointing to the strength of the movement as a whole. Fortunately, we've built a mass movement that isn't controlled by any one individual. Hochul's still going to have to listen to the people if she wants those votes, and the people are saying tax the rich. So, like, I mean, I think people need to think about this dialectically and say, like, Mamdani has his own incentives, but also DSA doesn't need to, like, you know, follow his every beck and call and have their own sort of priorities, which is, I think, you know, not exactly aligned with Kathy Hochul.
Yeah. And I would say, like, you know, from the perspective of delivering for both for New Yorkers and again for the broader movement, Mamdani endorsing Hochul and DSA as an organization and folks generally to the left supporting Delgado, these things are not necessarily at odds with each other. This is the way you get your cake and eat it too. And it's maybe not always clear which of these two bets are going to provide the cake, but they also work towards getting that cake. I may have lost where I was in the cake and eating it too.
You just started thinking about cake.
Yeah, exactly. I got a little discounted. I should have said like cracker, and maybe I wouldn't have been so distracted.
Even so,
by sweets.
You can't say that on Twitch.
It's true. Speaking of,
do this racist ad thing that.
Yeah, probably 13. Oh.
Well, I was just going to talk, since we were talking about food, I was going to go right to...
You're hungry today.
Yeah, it's true. What's a third... Oh, yeah, let's do this. Donald Trump, did he just retweet it or did he produce it himself?
No, he retweeted it. It came out in, I believe, April. I have the date in there, last year. It's the guy who made the jet fighter poop AI video.
Oh,
remember
I
that?
Recognize one his of my work favorites. From anywhere. His artistic flair.
Who is that guy? Oh, you just, it's the same.
His Twitter name's in the sound sheet.
Here is Donald Trump retweeting. Do we have the retweet?
Yeah, I'll put the retweet up.
God, here. In his bio is the jet fighter poop guy as his claim to fame.
Give him $1 million.
Can we bring back shame, please?
Here is, I actually think that this is Donald Trump going a step too far And again, like, I don't want to like imply that people, but
a goose step too far.
When Donald Trump went after or blamed Rob Reiner for his son killing him because he was not or allegedly killing him because of Trump derangement syndrome, I think Trump, it became very difficult for people to support that.
He lost Rob Schneider.
Just other reactionaries I know, like when they're coming at me, you know, via text, would say like, I'm against what he said about Rob Reiner, and then just go on to like some other thing. Like,
well, we played that clip from Emily Jashinsky, the conservative from Breaking Points, but I guess she was on off after Megyn Kelly on the radio, and
she
they
was had it for Megyn on Sirius.
They had a bunch of calls from, it was mostly conservative women saying how they were offended by what Trump said,
and much of this has to do with like how defensible is what Trump is doing, how much can you slough it off. They want to be associated. They also want some a plausible deniability. So when Trump goes after Colin Kaepernick, it's because he's being disrespectful to the flag, as opposed to, you know, going off of a white person's protest.
Right.
This, I think, is just too explicit. And I think this is going to embarrass some Trump supporters in a way of like, I really don't like it when he tweets, you know, but here it is. This guy put Obama and Michelle Obama's faces onto the body of apes.
Not even give him that much credit. He prompted AI to do that.
AI to do it.
And I'm saying AI is not
a racist artist. He's a racist hack.
Yeah. It's not art.
A racist prompt engineer. Yeah.
It was sufficient enough that Tim Scott had to say, praying it was fake on Twitter. Pop this up. Praying it was fake because it's the most racist thing we've seen out of this White House. The president should remove it. And by praying it was fake, he was basically saying like, hey, guys, maybe if you can pretend it was fake, but they didn't. And Donald Trump ended up deleting it, which is why we wanted to make sure that people knew that he posted in the first place.
When Tim Scott says the most racist thing he's seen, what other racist things has Tim Scott noticed but not commented on? I would like a list. It's nice that you have this sensitivity. Because, yeah, this is undeniable. But, like, what other racist things
when
have you...
Biden said corn pop?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Yeah, mention some Biden stuff.
This is, like, there's no... It was so blatantly racist that there was not the wiggle room that a lot of his supporters need to pretend that they're not racist.
It's the true face of the Republican Party.
Yeah, Sorry,
just to jump in real quick again. Like, this is the party that, and during the financial crisis, was talking about Barack Obama was born in Africa. Like, it's just Nazis on that side, and we have an entire media apparatus that can't say that and hasn't been able to say that for decades now. But these are just Klansmen.
That party, I mean, it was Trump. Like, is there a figurehead more responsible for the birther conspiracy in the world than Donald Trump?
No.
No. So, I mean, and that's a good, like, Trump is the Republican. Well, I mean, I know Hillary started it, and that you're not going to get any arguments from me on how racist Hillary Clinton was in 2008 towards Obama. But in this actual iteration of the conspiracy theory, that's Trump. Trump is the Republicans, and the Republicans are Trump. So I don't know what reality Tim Scott's living in, but
let's. It was a story I read. I think it was in the Times today. Not actually sure where it was. The IRS has been so degraded that people are concerned there's going to be a major meltdown. When the IRS has to process taxes this year. Eric Katz, I can't tell. I think this is from the Times. setting this agency up for failure amid staffing crunch. IRS taps employees with no relevant experience to assist during filing season. Tax agency is taking unusual steps to prepare for its busy season after Watchdog finds it severely underprepared. This is by design. Because the right wing does not want the taxes to be collected properly.
Unless this is reposted, it looks like it's governmentexec.com.
Oh, yes. Sorry. It's governmentexec.com. That's my New York Times. And the divisions in IRS that process tax returns and provide telephonic and in-person customer service, as well as other duties related to filing season, have lost 8,300 workers, or 17% of their staff. Almost one-fifth. The division tasked with processing original and amended tax returns has hired just 50 employees in anticipation of the 26th filing, or 2% of its authorized level. It can take up to 80 days to train a new employee. There were people who ostensibly leftists who were like, all of these new IRS hires. Well, it was what's his face?
Yeah. The IRS guys are coming to make you take the shot.
Yeah, exactly. Jimmy Dore. And the IRS for a couple of years under Biden began to audit the wealthiest taxpayers, because you obviously need more people and more sophisticated auditors, because you're going up against lawyers and whatnot. That's all gone. That's all gone. So what you're going to see is actually a greater level of enforcement percentage-wise of people who don't make much money, even like earned income tax folks. And what you'll also see is just a absolute crap show in terms of returns. With that said, let's also play this clip number 15. Donald Trump sold the part of their big, beautiful bill on the idea that there was going to be no tax on overtime. And the media spent very little time actually breaking this down. Now, if you listen to this program, you would have known this. If you read, The American Prospect, you would have known this. But for the 99.99999% of the rest of the country, they didn't know this. And some people seem to be discovering that the no tax on overtime isn't all that. It turns out there's no tax literally just on overtime. So if you work 50 hours, you get 10 hours of overtime. You get time and a half for those 10 hours, but it's only the half that is actually, there's no tax on.
So the time.
The time. You're still getting taxed.
No tax on the half.
And it's income tax, not payroll tax. Payroll tax still subjected to payroll tax.
No income tax on the half.
Yeah, the Social Security and all that stuff.
Social Security, wow. Medicare, you're still on the hook for.
You're and, welcome.
I mean, but don't worry. We kept the minimum wage stable, so you'll be able to rely on that. Yeah, watch as people realize.
All right, Trump. It's not cool, man. No tax on overtime. Well, I'm just now finding out that no tax on overtime is not no tax on overtime. There is tax on overtime. It's no tax on the half.
I mean, every time you hear Donald Trump open his mouth, it's no tax on overtime. But don't fill us full of shit and tell us that we're not paying taxes on overtime, because we're paying taxes on two-thirds of it.
So I filed our taxes this morning, and the no tax on overtime should be changed to no tax on some of your overtime, because the time and a half part that you get paid, it's the half that they won't tax. and that is less than one third of what my husband actually made on his overtime. So either way, they find a way to fuck you.
He wants to make it seem like he's doing something for the working class, but if you look at the tax breaks that millionaires and billionaires got, it's not even comparable. We still got shit on.
True. And
it
could be a real benefit in competent Democrats' favor if you really emphasize that this if you really emphasize that these tax cuts, the repeated emphasis on tax cuts, does nothing really to address the affordability crisis. Because, yeah, maybe you have a few hundred dollars extra in the cuts that you got from, like, your tax rate decreasing. But that doesn't necessarily do anything about your day-to-day issues with paying rent. It may be beneficial in the short term. But the price of everything is way too high. That's the major problem. That's what's driving people. That's why people are living paycheck to paycheck. That's why we keep hitting records of credit card debt. Do we have that More Perfect Union clip, actually? This might be a way... The one on the Affirm rent. Like, this is the major problem in America right now, is that people just simply can't afford basic goods, important services, or can't afford basic goods, the essentials of life, their rent. And we've been sounding the alarm on how, like... corporate companies like DoorDash and other food services are starting to offer buy now, pay later services. Like if you want to order a $20 lunch, if you're the kind of person that can't afford a $20 lunch at that time, and then you put it into four different installments, you are very likely to be the person that misses a payment. And then the interest rates get jacked up. They've been doing this at checkout for a lot of, like, clothing stores online and things like that. Then they're trying to expand it into food. And now it looks like rent now, pay later is the next frontier.
Yeah. With this, here we go with this. You've heard of buy now, pay later. Well, Lauren, what's this about rent now, pay later?
It's a new option for renters who are struggling to make the monthly payment. You can spread your payments out.
So gross.
Companies like Flex and Affirm are letting users break up their rent sums into multiple payments throughout the month.
Nice.
So let's say your rent is $2,000. You pay $1,400 on the first of the month, the remaining $600 on the 15th of the month. Hmm. Typically, it depends on the service that you use. You pay them a fee or a monthly subscription. But if you miss the payments, that's when the interest rates go way up. So, look, I get it. Rent is expensive and people are struggling to get by. But if you can't make your rent when you're supposed to, you might need to
find
somewhere else to live. You might need to find somewhere else to live. As opposed to, this should be illegal. You know,
The country's failing you.
This is like a new way to do payday lending. Across the country for a variety of different services. Yeah, maybe the interest rate doesn't look as astronomical as soon as you take out the loan, but if you miss the payment, you're already in an insanely high interest rate territory, and it just compounds upon itself. So for basic shelter, we're entrapping people in debt, and this should be absolutely illegal. There should be no reason that this kind of service is allowed to be used in this country.
And this is why one of the signs when I look back on 2024 and what were the indications that this was going wrong, when Harris started tailing this policy, this brainless libertarian idiocy, Harris endorses eliminating taxes on tips touting policy first proposed by Trump. So there was no vision there. But the premise of that is that the reason you're not getting ahead or are behind indeed is because the government is taking too much in taxes, not because your boss and capitalism, broadly speaking, have failed to create a life for you. It's the government. Again, it was libertarian. And it'd be nice to have a party with its head on its shoulders and understand like who the actual culprit is. But Kamala Harris was expecting them to the titans of industry to save democracy instead.
Didn't happen. We should also say there's no taxes on tips, which, if I remember correctly,
only ends up impacting maybe about half of the tipped workers because the other half don't make enough to qualify for income tax. So having no tax on income that was already not taxed is not a benefit.
You know? Weren't banker bonuses? Am I getting this
wrong? They were talking about it, but okay. I think supposedly they effectively limited it to areas to occupations that regularly typically got. Okay.
Maybe next time.
Next time, guys. But you still have your little carried interest loophole, so it's all good.
Don't get greedy this time.
It's all good.
You want to do this economy thing with Clinton?
Oh, yeah. While we're talking about the economy, let's do this. Job layoffs in January, the beginning of the year. Typically, you get some seasonal stuff that's adjusted, though. But we have not had a worse January for layoffs since 2009. I will remind you, the financial crisis of 2008, essentially, if I remember correctly, came to head in October and began what was known as the Great Recession. I'm not saying we're going to get a Great Recession, but not a very auspicious way. And there is an interesting dynamic that's going on. GDP appears, in terms of the numbers we've seen, appears to be growing at a rate that is not consistent with job losses. Now, there's three or four explanations for this. One is that the job losses are a leading indicator and GDP is going to end up slowing to reflect the job losses. Mm-hmm. Or job losses are a lagging indicator and the increase in GDP is going to mean we're going to stop having job losses and the economy is going to improve. Or some numbers are messed up, which I think is probably unlikely. Or there's a fourth explanation, which is that GDP measures things like revenue and profit, and that it's quite possible that our GDP now is a function of a very specific cohort in our society, very wealthy people who have so much money that they're spending for people who don't have any money.
Corporate profits are now at 16%, the highest level in modern history. We showed that chart the other day on the show. That would completely match with your assessment. We've also seen other statistics about how top-heavy consumer spending
10%
is.
10% of the population 10%. Is creating 50% of the sort of consumer activity. And so it's quite possible we are just now in an era where GDP measures economic activity, but does not indicate how widespread that economic activity is.
It's also heavily concentrated in AI and that speculative bubble. And there's a lot of other indications that that is going to burst at some point soon.
So GDP may have been at X 30 years ago, and that indicated that 7 or 8 people out of 10 were participating in the economy and making money, and that was driving GDP growth. Whereas now it's more like 2 or 3 or 4 people are driving that GDP growth, and the other 6 are like SOL. I guess we'll see going forward. But here is an indication of that may give us a clue as to what's going on out there. Again, there was a similar dynamic during Biden's last year, too. But here's Harry Emden.
Oh, I guess the question, as we get closer and closer to the midterms, which party do people trust knowing how they feel about how Donald Trump has handled things when it comes to the economy?
Right. The economy, right? Affordability. You know, Donald Trump has been dismissing affordability concerns. But when 54% say the top priority should be lowering prices, not much of a surprise, right? Party trusted more in affordability. Overall, it's the Democrats by 14. Look at this. Among independents, it's 39 points. It's a blowout. This is the entire ball game right here. And when you're having a 39-point lead among independents, a 14-point lead overall on affordability, and right now the top priority, the Americans say, should be lowering prices for the Trump administration, this is the type of formula that equals major success for the Democrats come the midterms, if it holds.
And we have seen that in the special elections. We'll see if that holds in the midterms.
We shall see, Sarah. Hair.
Oh, I guess.
They're just having the time of their lives. Yeah. This is where the Trump coalition and its lack of durability is going to come into focus here, because Trump didn't win 50% of the popular vote, but he did win the popular vote the first time a Republican has done so in quite some time. There were a lot of people that jumped the gun because they didn't want to be like left behind as the culture realigned towards MAGA and towards fascism, where you see that coalition that he built was one that was based really on the failure of the Democrats and the failure of really the Biden administration to meaningfully address their economic situation, as well as depressing turnout from their base by supporting the genocide in Gaza. But like, that coalition of voters, the swing of Latino voters to Trump during that time period, was because the economy was going really, really poorly and people couldn't afford basic goods. And so they voted for the party that was out of power, and lower information voters trended towards Donald Trump for that reason. So the Democrats could capitalize on this. You have to make it durable if like that coalition is as squishy as it looks like.
The good news is that Robert F. Kennedy has found a cure for some of the most debilitating neurological and psychological challenges that people have. This looks like a sketch. And it also is just weird because every single person in frame that you could make out is a guy, just some old white guy.
Well,
health guys.
I mean, who cares about women's health? Like, that's kind of been the consensus about research for time in memoriam anyway.
Why spend time on researching about girls? That's we've got to address medicine. So why would we spend time on that? Anyways, all they do is send you naked pictures against your will. So here is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He is in charge of the Health and Human Services, and unfortunately for the rest of us, he was reading something the other day. And here he is explaining how we can get rid of things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder.
Dr. Pollan up at Harvard has cured schizophrenia using keto diets. There are studies right now that I saw 2 days ago where people lose their bipolar diagnosis by changing their diet. So it's not only affecting our physical health, it's affecting our mental health as well. And we're asking people now, eat real food, right? Eat protein. Dr. Pollan.
Eat real food and just get happy. We should make it clear, it's not Pollan.
Pollan'd.
Pollan'd.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if maybe he got it wrong, because he's not digging too. I know it was doctor with an O and an L and a P, and they've cured schizophrenia.
seems like a big story. That must have been what happened to Kanye. He stopped eating pasta, and then he took out that ad in the Wall Street Journal to say, I actually like Jews.
Here's the
Kanye was having carbs.
Here's the problem.
Wait, it's Palmer, not Polland.
Okay.
Kennedy was apparently referring to Dr. Christopher Palmer, who in 2019 wrote about two patients with longstanding schizophrenia who experienced complete remission of symptoms.
Okay, but I got the T part, right? And O-A, it sounds similar, right?
Two patients? That's the sample size?
And he did not respond to comment for the story.
He's shy.
I'm shocked that
that's modesty.
I'm shocked that what this like almost anecdotal story that RFK Jr. is citing didn't have rigorous methodology.
Two people. I think that's not almost anecdotal. It is anecdotal.
Yeah.
I saved my aunt. But, all that pasta killed my aunt.
But here's the thing, like, obviously it would be better for people to eat less processed food.
Yeah.
And just because it would be better. It would be.
He can just say that.
No. No, I can't.
You got to put the Rogan like sauce on it. Anybody like these sorts of studies, this happens in science. That's like the basic of science literacy is you don't overreact to one study.
No, but
yeah,
the idea is that the only way for us to raise money with our organizations are to maintain the idea that you're being lied to. And there's a secret truth out there about all of these diagnoses.
And none of it can be found in public health or in any institution that like has scientific credibility. It can all be found on your Instagram mm-hmm. feed, and it can all be found in the supplements that you purchase. And if you can't afford those, I mean, I guess you don't deserve to be healthy.
We have found that rendered snake fat, which is in term is snake oil, has cured cancer in two people.
Use coupon code
snake oil.
Snake oil and get 20% off. Snake oil BOGO.
Snake oil BOGO. I gotta buy it in crypto, though.
Yes. Incidentally, yeah. I've got a sale on my Bitcoin. I wonder if he sold out of his Bitcoin.
Oh, you saw the reporting today about how Bitcoin, like, despite the Trump administration's efforts, it's just continuing to fall. God, if only, but if only that industry died and the Democrats allowed it to, but instead we had Kirsten Gillibrand talking about how important it is for society.
Literally, the reporting is that Chuck Schumer was like desperately trying to get some crypto bills out of a conference the other day. I don't know if they succeeded. Huh? Pro-crypto? Oh, yes. Pro-crypto.
You know, maybe somebody who doesn't have any future in politics shouldn't be dictating the future of the Democratic Party.
Honestly,
in the middle of a fascist takeover of society.
You guys don't know what I'm talking about when I keep talking about Bullworth, but it was
no. I actually looked it up because I wanted to know what you're saying. It does fit very perfectly.
It is. It's actually a decent movie. I mean,
is
it was definitely.
Clinton, huh? Is it like based on Clinton Bullworth?
No. This is. Bullworth was a Warren Beatty movie, and it was about a politician who found out that he had like some terminal disease, and he sort of like has a network moment where he's just like, you know, he starts telling the truth, and he decides to start rapping. He's sort of losing his, and it's not particularly great rap, but it's all part of him just sort of like losing his mind a little bit, but also just getting actually honest, and people respond well to it.
Sounds a little like Network, but
that's what I'm saying. It's a little bit Network-y. But it's and I mean, it's definitely worth watching. It's not the greatest movie in the world, but it's definitely worth watching. It was also sort of like Warren Beatty deserves credit for using his fame in that way, because he made the movie himself or was able to do it at that time. But Chuck Schumer, it's as if like he's terminal. And so he starts doing all of the worst things he could possibly do, as opposed to the opposite.
Yeah.
Right.
Make-A-Wish time for Chuck Schumer's political career. More funds for Israel and no side deals with Iran and all the crypto for my friends on Wall Street.
People should go back to the whole C-SPAN interview he did where he said for every vote we lose in the Rust Belt, we'll gain two in the suburbs. That was specifically about immigration. No, they don't need to develop any kind of narrative.
That about immigration?
Yep.
Oh, you know, there was another thing that I always remember from the run-up of 2016. And I think this was in October of 2016. His big thing was, and I think this is part of the reason why they were trying. I mean, Hillary Clinton, without a doubt, was trying to structure her constituency that voted for her in a certain way.
Yeah.
And Schumer is on record saying, I've got Clinton, I've got Schumer, and I've got Ryan to make a deal to for infrastructure to repatriate offshore profits, to reshore profits, you needed to pay the normal tax rate, which was a reduced tax rate for a while, which was a Truman thing to build essentially the world. In the wake of World War II, George Bush suspended those taxes and at a reduced rate under the American Jobs Act of 2005, which ostensibly was going to create all these new jobs. And the biggest proponent of it, HP, ended up cutting 15,000 jobs after they repatriated all these profits and handed them out in stock buybacks to their shareholders. And Schumer, you know, Apple had billions upon billions of dollars and other companies, billions and billions of dollars they kept offshore instead of repatriating so they could avoid taxes, waiting for a discount. Mm-hmm. And Schumer was protecting Paul Ryan so they could make this deal ostensibly to spend money on infrastructure. And of course, that's why they never criticized Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell during that election, because they wanted to somehow make Donald Trump distinct from the Republican Party. But I don't even know what the point of that was, that digression. But there we are.
And that was how we were nibbling around the edges for the inequality crisis, or how much money is in corporations. We're going to do this holiday that we can't even campaign on.
Yep.
Meanwhile, like, look at pick a random city. Go to China, most populous cities by it ranked, and pick like the number 45. And search that city's infrastructure, and there may be two cities in America that have better infrastructure than whatever city you pick.
Maybe we'll play this next week. But I just saw like a video made by, I don't know who she is, some woman, American woman in China, going to see the doctor at a hospital, and she's like shows up at the hospital at 2:17, and goes through the entire process of seeing the doctor, paying for the doctor, getting a prescription, getting the medication. It takes her like 19 minutes to do all of that, and it costs $12. And she has no insurance. But we'll play that another time. Let's do number 23, shall we? Because, look, this has been very, very hard. For this Epstein stuff has obviously been very, very hard for some people. And Joe Rogan is having a tough time. He's here with Mike Benz. Will you Google Mike Benz, please? I feel like Patrick Bet David. Google Mike Benz.
Or Rogan himself.
Google Mike Benz. And put that up on the screen, Brian. Mike Benz. Put him up on the screen.
You sound Israeli somehow.
Well, I mean, that's...
Okay, is State Department?
Yeah, under, I think, Trump. Yeah,
it was the first Trump administration, and he worked under Rubio.
Keep going. And he worked under Rubio, but I think he also worked for Elon Musk.
Mm.
Go back up to his Wikipedia.
He doesn't have Wikipedia.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Why am I not seeing it?
Just Google Musk and Benz.
Take it down.
It's relevant because
it looks like a connection Is this the one you're talking about?
Yeah. Oh, Ben's was the one who did the targeting of USAID. Musk has cited Ben's research. Oh, about how the USAID had the secret, stolen election stuff. That's what it was. Ben's is this sort of like Musk is a conduit to Musk. And he's the one who I think had all the stolen election stuff like in through Germany or whatever it was. And here is and he's the one also who did all the stuff about why Musk should take over Twitter. Here he is talking about the Epstein files. Musk's name, oddly, never comes up. Because Joe Rogan has had like a dozen of the stars of the Epstein files in that room, basically shaping all of his politics.
This is from a YouTuber too lazy to try who cut these clips.
That's a very specific illicit desire to want underage people.
Well,
how do you even find out that someone's into that?
Well, I don't think that the majority or anything close to it of the women were technically, I mean, I think it was largely
young,
very young, you know, barely legal, so to speak. But, and I know that there were cases of underage, but I think
most of it was just
very, very young, but not like
20-year-old,
not
like
13-year-old type thing. And then, yeah, remember, because this is an international enterprise and many of the clients are like, you know, in countries that don't necessarily have the same norms about that,
right,
that we do, you can very easily see someone getting involved in that just because girls juice deals.
All right, so the Joe Rogan Experience is just getting set.
Girls juice deals.
Everyone knows that. Always saying that.
It's funny though. Like Rogan starts off by saying, "Remember now, all these people are tied into Epstein: Andreessen, Thiel, Musk. Who else on the that has been on his show? There's somebody's done like a whole infographic on it. And it's not just that he's had these guests on. It's not like, oh, that one time I had that guy on and he had been there, or I had Bobby Slayton on one time and he had been to a dinner. These are people who were sort of like intimately connected to Epstein's orbit, but also have shaped Rogan's political perspective on things, which is, you know, some of the revelations we were talking about with Ajit here about Epstein is like, they just skate above all of the laws and institutions. Steven Pinker, Peter Attia, Lawrence Krauss, all these people have been on.
And recently, too.
And recently.
But
so Rogan sits there and goes like, well, you know, you wouldn't have necessarily known this was it. Like his first line of defense is like, it's very possible a lot of people who knew Epstein had no idea this was going on. And then Mike Pence goes, well, actually, he takes another tact, like, because that's probably unlikely. It's that, you know, it really isn't as bad as you think it is.
The girls were sweeteners.
Because, A, it's probably only a few who are underage. The rest were, like, so close that the lines were blurry. And then, B, you know, you got to be culturally sensitive. Because for a lot of countries, that's not so strange. And then, you know, it's just the girls were shipped over there just as a way of making deals. So it's not so much that it was like perversion. It was just sort of the cost of doing business. But go ahead.
And convince people to say,
I also like that he's like, let's look into the Epstein files that have been released. Can you get me a guy from the State Department?
Yeah.
Right.
Blackmail operation.
And Jeffrey Epstein, you know, for the past 3 years of their lives has been the best weekend they've ever had. has, you know, has made them feel alive again in their, you know, mid-50s or 60s, has, you know, has opened all sorts of other deals for, you know, for them. And this deal might work out. So if I'm afraid that if I say no to Jeffrey Epstein on this deal, I'm not going to get an invite to the next party. I'm not going to be able to get laid again with.
In the public eye, the narrative is underage girls. And this is the thing that makes it so disgusting. When people talk about it, everyone says kids on the island. This is the big conspiracy about it. And this is the reason why people are so outraged about it.
My concern,
one part,
the runaway train on that is that,
no pun intended.
It's a massive manhunt for something that it may be true. To me, it's a needle in the haystack. It might be true. Good luck looking for it. It would seem ludicrous to me that Epstein doesn't mean it's impossible. But logistically, if Epstein ever directly threatened someone proactively, that is, if the person tries to blackmail Epstein, Epstein could, you know, reactively say, well, I've got shit on you too. But proactively and really, really do someone in like that, and word gets around that that happens, everything he built goes, the whole Rolodex finds out.
There are girls, there are public victims that talk about being underage. I mean, there's documentation about them being underage. I guess I'm being culturally insensitive.
But even if they're 18, you can't be fucking sex trafficked for the elites of the world.
Sex trafficking of adults, also illegal. Using coercive methods to bring in young, legal women in, also illegal. And what do you mean a needle in the haystack?
Well, you guys,
the government has videos of it.
We have the email guys, he drafted for Bill Gates.
You're not thinking about the nuance here, okay? You got to be nuanced when you talk about this. First off, you know, they're speaking as a guy in his late 50s. You hit a midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. And if you have the opportunity to go to some of the just best parties that you could go to on a sweet ass island,
who could resist?
It's like, if I had the opportunity to do that, and then I'd be like, oh, I got to make this deal so that I can keep going to the parties. Do you have any idea like how just dull Larry Summers' life was? And then all of a sudden he's got it's going to be guys' party. Guys,
Jeffrey brought
together
color back into his life again.
Absolutely.
Before Epstein came into Larry's life, it was he saw the world in black and white.
Nobody talks about what would things be like if folks were, you know, some of the biggest capitalists or thinkers in the were bummed or just depressed.
Well, I think that's the problem. Boring. We're all looking at it from the victim's perspective, like way, 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 way too much. We have to have empathy for everybody involved. And when you're a man in your 50s and you're a billionaire, there are very few ways for you to feel like a man in a new kind of way, a new rapaciousness, if you will, a new way of dominating somebody. So if you have a child that you can rape, it's like a way to, it's a confidence booster. Honestly shouldn't be so judgmental about people taking care of their mental health.
If there's a lot of like conspiracy theories going around that he somehow like used this for blackmail, but don't you think if he was blackmailing somebody, or somebody felt like the threat of blackmail. Okay. So like, for instance, I'm in my 50s. I want a party and I get invited to the island. I do stuff that is inappropriate or just barely inappropriate. And the implication is that now I know Jeffrey knows about this stuff and I'm going to like make some deals or do some stuff. don't you think that I would tell my other friends, hey, stay away from Jeffrey Epstein and even his like fun parties? Why? I don't know. I think you should stay away from him. Why do you keep going to those parties? Well, it's almost too late for me to stay away from them for no specific reason. I just want to give you a heads up at risk of what I'm being blackmailed for coming out. Not that I said that.
We talk about the two-tiered healthcare system in society and how the richest have access to all this incredible healthcare. Have we considered that the raping of children is what's keeping them alive, and it's the benefit that we don't get to experience? I mean,
yeah, it's a way to stay vibrant. Woody Allen is 150
years old.
I mean, Alan Dershowitz is still alive against all odds, but he kept his underwear on.
Incidentally, the podcast we were just watching, where they were basically parsing and splitting hairs and trying to be nuanced and trying to sort of tamp down speculation, is a podcast which has basically said we didn't land on the moon, has entertained almost every single possible conspiracy theory you could, and fabrication from kids are identifying as cats, and so much so that
no, including this one. I mean, I'm sorry, yes, but Rogan, yes, like in the 2016 aughts or whatever, was all over the Epstein conspiracy theory. And it's not a coincidence that all of these figures on the tech right at the same time Thiel in 2016 is emailing back and forth with Jeffrey Epstein, and Steve Bannon is emailing back and forth with Jeffrey Epstein. And a few years prior to that, you had Epstein meeting with the head of 4chan, and then the forum Paul, the political forum, is really quickly created right after that meeting. And that is one of the outgrowths that the so-called Q started posting his drops on until he moved over to 8chan. But 4chan is where QAnon originated. And around the same time, this podcast was engaging in conspiracy theories about Epstein and focusing only on the Clintons and focusing only on Democrats. You brought this up with Jeet. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of Hollywood in there. Why would we might have expected that Hollywood people would be in there besides like Woody Allen and Brett Ratner or whatever? Because all of their freakouts about this were centered around the Hollywood elite cabal being involved with Jeffrey Epstein. These guys, these tech billionaires, a guy like Peter Thiel, they were consciously redirecting energy away from the real pedophiles.
Yes. Here is, let's just look at the video first. Here is Peter Thiel. I don't know when he went on Rogan's show to talk about when he met Epstein, but he's going to be articulated right here. He met with Epstein a few times, but it was all about taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, here we go. Let's listen to this video.
I met Epstein a few times as well, and I think...
How'd you get introduced?
It was Reid Hoffman in Silicon Valley introduced us in 2014, but it was basically, I didn't ask enough questions about it, but I think there were sort of a lot of things where it was fraudulent. I do think Epstein knew a lot about taxes, and. And there were probably, you know, these complicated ways you could structure a nonprofit organization, especially as a way in a marital context that I think Epstein might have known a decent amount about.
I wonder why he put in a marital context. To imply that, like, oh, I didn't do any of that stuff. I wasn't married. The marriage wasn't legal at the time. And so I didn't do that. Here's what's weird. And he sort of implies he's meeting him because of only, like, financial structuring of things.
Is tax expertise, like, rare?
Yeah, that's the thing.
Is that
well,
hard to find?
Well, hiding money mm-hmm.
is that even rare?
Well,
yeah, right.
If you find somebody who's really good at it.
Epstein
really
might have been the best of the best.
He certainly.
Teal's just going to pay for the time. He's like, I'm not interested in that, but I want you to help me hide my money from like the law.
Now, of course, this is weird. Jeffrey Epstein emailed Peter Thiel back in 2014. That was fun. See you in 3 weeks.
I have experience with
H&R
Block.
I love talking about tax. Exactly. Whenever I talk to my tax attorney, I'm always like, dude, that was fun. Oh, let's do it again. 3 weeks.
We only do this once a year, man.
Yeah, exactly. Walking past the H&R Block office, it's like, I don't have to go here for another 8 months. So much fun. I wish I had a reason just to stop in and say hi.
You're knocking on the window. Hey, I'll see you soon. That's good.
That's the thing about tax advice is I like to get it on a 3 week basis.
I like to wear my Statue of Liberty costume and I dance around while we do our taxes. I have a blast.
You just said something. Just one more point on this. You said something about how Rogan traffics in all those conspiracy theories on his show.
Until recently.
But like, is that not suspicious in and of itself? Like, Matt, you've talked about the UFO conspiracy stuff a lot. And, like, you know, it's interesting to a degree. But the most likely explanation is for, like, the phenomenons we're seeing in the sky are weapons technologies or surveillance technology that's not explainable to people that our governments are testing out.
Stealth bomber was exactly that.
And so it's like, but he's spent a lot of time on his show not talking about it and speaking about UFOs in a context that doesn't really implicate the existing power structures. I'm just saying that the framework of the conspiracy theory sounds a little similar to how he talked about Epstein for all those years.
I think this guy basically is just a sop for money. And they come in, they tell him a story. And
Joe's worth hundreds of millions of dollars himself. Like these are his friends. He hangs out with these people.
But the dynamic is, I am quite convinced, it may appear on its face, mutuals, but they open their mouth and he just hangs on every word.
Yep.
And regardless of how ridiculous, I mean, like the Andreessen stuff when he was talking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, like it just all of it could be total BS, but he's just hanging on every word. But
we should keep going a little bit if we can.
Okay.
I know it's late, but this is just the rest of this. Some interesting comments made here about Epstein.
Oh, so his arrest was the first arrest, right?
Yeah.
Which was like 2007,
08.
Okay. Okay. And so.
But, you know, you assume he didn't go to jail for that long. It was probably not as serious as alleged. Mm. There was the illusion that there were all these other people that I trusted. You know, Reed, who introduced us, was, you know, he started LinkedIn. He was
Reed Hoffman.
You know, maybe too focused on business networking, but
right.
That was fun.
But I thought he always had good judgment in people.
When the shit went down and Epstein gets arrested for the second time, were you like, oh, well, there you go?
I've thought about it.
Sort of.
Also, like, there's no reason to have him on your show. But unless it's to like really go at him because he is literally like creating Big Brother.
But to Sam's point, like, you know, there's what's that adage about people in Congress being millionaires? They're servicing billionaires. I mean, that's kind of the dynamic of Rogan.
100%. Exactly.
Rogan and the billionaires on his show. Yeah. It's pretty disgusting, that first clip. Goddamn. I went pretty heavy
really
in
gross.
The sarcasm, but that's all you can do to deal with that kind of depravity. Holy moly.
It's the Megyn Kelly thing of like where she was trying to do the barely legals thing too, even though she made the mistake of citing the age 15.
Well, I'm glad they're telling on themselves that the party that was always in favor of lowering the age of consent and making it so that in certain states in the country, child marriage would be legal, are back to their fucking roots here.
Definitely not Cameron. Not as serious as alleged. He was convicted. Yeah, but you know, you always see multi-millionaires convicted willy-nilly in those situations.
Oh, island owners always get like the book thrown at them.
Well, the implication is we've all done some stuff like that, haven't we?
Yeah.
She doesn't give you her ID.
Doesn't throw an occasional
or he doesn't.
Out of a window.
Incidentally,
I want to go there, but
incidentally. By 2017, everybody who had access to a newspaper or the internet was fully aware that Epstein had gotten a sweetheart deal by Alex Acosta because it was all over the place because he was named labor secretary. I mean, I'm just trying to give an outer bounds of what would be reasonable time frame to be completely ignorant of everything and not know it. Skid Mark Twain. Epstein was just a subject matter expert on taxes. All right, I'm going to read five of these and we got to go. Minneapolis psychologist. Emma's such a kink shamer. Jehovah's Witnesses, RFK Jr., we're finding that yellow snow has better enzymes and minerals than other colors of snow. We're adding yellow snow to the base of food pyramid and ensuring schools are aware of this.
Just a quick exchange, 2018. Peter Thiel, or Jeffrey Epstein to Peter Thiel, New York, question mark? Peter Thiel, avoiding the zoo, Jeffrey Epstein, animals are fun to watch sometimes. Peter Thiel, smiley face.
Smiley face.
I'm talking about taxes. Yeah.
Social conservative, fiscal liberal. Bulworth doesn't have a terminal illness. He has a psychotic break and hires a hitman to kill himself. Oh, right. That's what it was. He hired a hitman to kill himself, and he thought he was going to die.
Well, that's, kind of, that's a good idea.
I forgot about that.
A lot of work.
Okay.
It's an exciting way to go out.
Chris Burdick. That's a very funny YouTube channel called This Age Great, where they make fun of movies that are problematic and don't hold up well. They had a field day with Bulworth, particularly with Halle Berry calling Warren Beatty the N-word in what's supposed to be a romantic way. Yeah.
Well, at least it's in the right direction.
I forgot about that part of it. Holtenheim, gotta love how normal people have been saying this for over two decades. Cryptocurrency's only case use is money laundering, and then somehow the market freaks out when the bros learn the crime coins were used for heinous crimes.
I love the crypto guys being shocked at this. Like, who did you think was the whales were, you idiots?
Yeah.
All right, two more. CT Majority Report Joiner. Hey, Sam, Emma, crew, I wanted to plug two exciting campaigns in Connecticut. Josh Elliott running against incumbent Ned Lamont for governor, and Kyle Gauck is running against incumbent Joe Courtney for 2nd District House seat. Both are establishment Dems who've proven to be weak in these trying times. Could go into more detail, but both incumbents have bent their knees to Trump, supported ICE, and represented the rich above the poor, despite Connecticut having a large progressive undercurrent. And the final I Am of the Week. The Mad Mailman, not to mention it's only no tax on Fair Labor Standards Act overtime. Those of us with a union contract like myself have tons of situations where our overtime is still being taxed in its entirety. Matt, Brian, Emma, Dorsey, Kyle, Julie, Whitney, and Corey,
Gino.
And Gino, and Chris, and Maria, great job this week. See you Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid.